Hello and welcome to the Reaction Podcast. I'm Max Mitchell, political reporter here at Reaction, and I'm standing in for Ian Martin. He'll be back next week. In the upcoming Indian elections, which begin tomorrow, Friday the 19th of April, almost 1 in 8 people in the world are eligible to cast a vote. Prime Minister Narendra Modi is seeking a third consecutive term. In opposition, hoping to dethrone him and his BJP party, is the Indian National Developmental Inclusive Alliance, or India for short. The India Alliance is a coalition of many different parties, one of which is the Congress Party, which, with the Nehru-Gandhi family at the helm, almost exclusively ruled India from its independence in 1947 until 1996, when the BJP gained a foothold in mainstream Indian politics. Since then, Indian politics has been ruled by the forces of Hindu nationalism. Some argue that the four pillars of the Indian Republic, as conceived by its founding Prime Minister, democracy, secularism, socialism, and non-alignment in foreign affairs, have all but disappeared. With me to discuss modern India, the elections, and his book, Malevolent Republic, A Short History of the New India, is author and journalist Kapil Komireddy. Kapil, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you for joining us. So, where are you calling from?
I'm currently in Hyderabad, which is the northernmost city in southern India. And it's a very important city in India's history. This is where the agitation to reform India or reorganize Indian territory after the British left began. And India was reorganized into linguistic states as a result of the agitation that began here. And this is also the only part of southern India where there was violence. When India was partitioned in the name of religion into when Pakistan was invented as a homeland for Indian Muslims, the ruler of this particular state, Nizam of Hyderabad, who was the richest man in the world at the time, threatened to build a bridge from Hyderabad to Pakistan. It's unimaginable, a mad project, but he was very serious about it. And the Indian government took action. It's called police. They called it police action, and they liberated the city and integrated it into India. So it's a very important city in the history of the Indian Republic. It's also the IT hub of India. It's got the biggest Amazon office in the world. It's got the Uber headquarters. It's got the largest IKEA in this region. So it's an IT powerhouse. I think it's called Cyberabad. And it is it's the Silicon Valley of India. That's how it used to be known in the 90s.
Sounds like a fascinating flashpoint. So many totemic issues in India have been lived through the history of that city.
That's right. It's a remarkable city, and it's a city where there are Muslims and Hindus, and they've largely lived in peace. And the Hindu nationalism that is coursing through the rest of India hasn't fully infected the Hindu citizens of this city, and particularly the state. The city is the capital of a state called Telangana, which is the youngest state in India. It was created in 2014, and the BJP hasn't been able to make inroads in the state yet, but I think that might change in the years to come.
Okay, so what is the atmosphere like ahead of these staggeringly huge six-week elections? What is the atmosphere like in Hyderabad?
Well, in Hyderabad, I can't really say. I've been absent from Hyderabad because Hyderabad doesn't go to the polls tomorrow. But I've been elsewhere in India. I've been in the deepest north and the most extreme south. I was in Varanasi, which is the holiest city in Hinduism and the parliamentary constituency of the prime minister. And I was in Allahabad, which is, again, a very important city in the Indian Republic's history, because that is where the Nehru family begin their political journey. And then I was in Kerala in southern India, the most literate state in India, the first state, I believe, in the world where there was a democratically elected communist government. And it's been ruled by communists for decades. And it's a very progressive state, a highly literate state, where there's a very important contest taking place between the Congress Party in the capital of that state, which is called Thiruvananthapuram or Trivandrum. There is a contest taking place between a man called Shashi Tharoor, who is the Congress candidate and possibly the most charismatic Congress leader, the only man with a national profile to rival the prime minister. And the man who's up against him is Rajiv Chandrasekhar, whom I spend time with. He's a billionaire. If he were British, he'd be one of the richest people in Britain. He's an IT billionaire. He made his money after India's economic liberalization in the 1990s. And he's been parachuted into the seat. He's originally from there, but he's lived most of his life outside of Kerala, which is also true of Shashi Tharoor. He spent a lot of time at the United Nations and very nearly succeeded Kofi Annan and has been an MP for 3 terms. And so that contest is very, very important because if the Congress candidate were to lose, Indian Parliament, the next parliament, will effectively be deprived of one of the most eloquent interrogators of this government. So I went there to report on that, and it was a very, very enlightening and edifying experience because I could see the penetration of the BJP into places where it was unthinkable that the BJP would ever gain a foothold. At the same time, I also saw the other side of India that is very powerfully resistant to the message of the BJP, which pits Indian against Indian, which is a sectarian message. In fact, the BJP's candidate, Rajiv Chandrasekhar, said to me bluntly that I'm a secularist. He was disavowing the central animating theme of his own political party in order to be credible in that city.
How interesting that those forces have changed, that a pillar of the Indian Republic seems to be almost a derogatory term to call someone now a secularist. But I must ask, are these elections free and fair? Rajiv Kumar, Chief Election Commissioner, has said that his commission will take democracy to every corner of India. He said, "Our teams will walk the extra mile to reach every voter, whether they are in jungles or on snowy mountains. We will go on horseback, elephants, mules, or helicopters. We will reach everywhere." Now, this is all very well and good, but how democratic are these elections?
Well, think about it, Max. Think about it this way. Picture the Indian election. It is the largest exercise of its kind in the world. And every 5 years, it's bigger than the previous election because the size of the electorate keeps increasing. So at this election, there are 969 million eligible voters. That's more than the population of Europe. These are people who can cast a vote in this election. And there are more than 2,600 political parties. And for an organization tasked with overseeing this election, it's a gargantuan task. And they have 15 million personnel. And the rules state that no voter should walk more than 2 kilometers to cast their vote. And that rule is rigorously implemented. So at the last election in 2019, I remember that officials of the Election Commission scaled the Himalayas to meet one voter. They set up a polling booth in a wildlife sanctuary where there was again a lone human being. They went to a village with oxygen masks because there was an elderly woman living there in a remote part of India. So it's a remarkable thing, Indian elections, and they are free, but are they fair? Are they fair is the very big question in 2024. Rather than answer that question directly, let me try and illustrate what is happening in India right now. The Chief Minister of Delhi, Arvind Kejriwal, perhaps the most successful politician in India's history, because he founded his political party in 2012, just over a decade ago. And his party is now in power in 2 states, in Delhi, which is the national capital region, and in Punjab, the neighboring state. That is extraordinary success in a matter of 10 years. Political parties usually take 20 years, 30 years just to break through. And that man is charismatic, eloquent, and a serious threat to the prime minister. Guess where he is right now? He's in a jail outside the capital. And he's been picked up on accusations of corruption, and he cannot be freed because there's a piece of legislation called the PMLA that was amended to give broad powers to the investigative agencies and also enjoin the courts by saying that you cannot release a suspect unless you are absolutely certain that he or she is completely innocent. And no court can conceivably arrive at that judgment in the absence of a trial. So effectively to be arrested under that law is to be found guilty and expected to prove your innocence. And the Chief Minister of Delhi, the most high-profile prisoner in India right now, high-profile political prisoner, I'd call him a political prisoner, and he's out of the competition. He's unable to organize his political party, and he's the only one. There are many others. There's something called the ED, which is the Enforcement Directorate, which is the tax crime fighting agency that has been transformed by Modi into his personal force. And what they do is they turn up at your house. There's a knock on the door in the morning, and they bring up some irregularity in your tax affairs, something or the other, and they then cart you away. And many Indian politicians have, as a result of being harried and harassed by this agency, ended up joining the BJP. And when they join the BJP, all the cases disappear. So, and then you look at the institutional fairness. The Election Commission has repeatedly received complaints about the most egregious kinds of violations of its regulations by the governing party, and it's done very little. But when it's the opposition, it's very, very vigorous and active in pursuing those complaints. Similarly, with the media, the fourth estate, there is really no free press in India, in the sense that the press isn't being coerced so much as it has been co-opted by the government. The press is largely owned by private companies, and they all seem to have done a deal with the Prime Minister that they will not criticize him. So there's no critical coverage of the Prime Minister. China has seized thousands of square kilometers of Indian territory over the past 3 years, and there is absolutely no commentary on that in the Indian press. And Modi is effectively portrayed as a strong man and a nemesis of India's enemies. And yet he has presided over the most humiliating loss of territory to China, the most humiliating defeat at the hands of China in decades. And he's really a weakling in that sense. And there's nobody to hold him to account. There are certain independent small presses, but they simply do not have the footprint to challenge the Prime Minister. And then there is the banking system, then there is a police system, then there is the other agencies of government, the institutions upon which the constitutional structure of the Republic is built. They've all been subverted. And Modi's premiership really has been, I think, an object lesson in how you can subvert a democracy. And right now we have free elections. You can go and cast your ballot. But are there fair elections? I met a voter in northern India, in the Prime Minister's constituency, who told me that everything that's gone wrong in the past decade, he blamed it on the Congress Party, which is an opposition, which doesn't even qualify to be the formal opposition because it doesn't have enough seats in Parliament. And there is a segment of India's population that believes that if the Congress is voted back to power, they will sell India to China. There is, I don't know how substantial that segment is. And then there is the deluge of lies, falsehoods that course through WhatsApp and other communication channels that portray the Prime Minister as India's savior, India's redeemer. There are memes that circulate that say the Prime Minister was voted the greatest living Prime Minister by UNESCO. And people tend to believe this. And this is an extraordinarily toxic cocktail of lies and appliance media and enervated institutions. The result of that is the Prime Minister begins this race. Have you seen a film called The Dictator with Sacha Baron Cohen?
Unfortunately, I have.
There's a scene in it where he's running. He starts the race ahead of everyone else, and he starts shooting everyone else in the
Oh,
course of
yes,
that
of
race. It's a bit like
course.
that. It's a bit like that. Modi is like that. So there is a race taking place, but the Prime Minister is also firing at everyone else, and he's going to crown himself the winner. And I fear that if he were to win the next election, and it looks very likely that he may win the next election, it looks highly likely. I think we will have reached a point of no return at that point. Where will we be after 5 years of another Modi term? In his first term, he effectively coerced every institution that might have held him to account. In the second in a second term, he set up a cult of personality unrivaled in the democratic world. There is actually a stadium, the largest in India, named after the Prime Minister. He's a living figure who has a stadium named after himself. But the only other person I think who did that was Gaddafi in Libya. The Prime Minister has that. He had a satellite shot into space bearing his name, or his face was shot into space. And during on his birthdays, school kids are corralled into schools and made to endure his speeches. And he's been described as the Messiah of the poor. And he was congratulated in 2021 by his party as the man who saved the world from COVID. And India ended up becoming the epicenter of COVID a few weeks later. So he's erected a cult of personality that has no equal in the democratic world, none whatsoever. And I think there are about 22 people in India who own 70% of India's wealth. And having come to office, promising to eradicate corruption and create jobs, he's presided over the creation of an oligarchic paradise. There are a handful of oligarchs that run the Indian economy. It's very much like the Russian model. And speaking of employment, 83% of India's youth that make up the largest demographic segment in the country, 83% of India's youth are unemployed or underemployed, according to the ILO. So that's staggering. And yet he keeps winning and he's invincible for the reasons I cited earlier.
Yes. So free, but not necessarily fair elections. Dissent seems to have been stifled in a whole
That's right.
host of places. There doesn't seem to be any realistic challenge to Modi. It doesn't seem like the India coalition has support or indeed power to actually campaign properly. Arvind Kejriwal is in jail. Does Rahul Gandhi pose any threat at all?
I think Rahul Gandhi is the Prime Minister's greatest asset. I think if Rahul Gandhi were to, were to disappear, the Prime Minister would send a search party to find him and bring him back, because he is the Prime Minister's useful idiot. This man,
Right.
let me tell you something. Consider the biography of the Prime Minister. Everything I've told you about the Prime Minister, his tendencies as a strongman, are one aspect of his biography. There's the other aspect. This is a man born into extreme poverty. His mother used to clean people's houses. His father used to sell tea. He belongs to a lower caste community in a country that is extremely conscious of these differences. It makes Britain look like, an amateur. And this man rises from that station to the pinnacle of political power in India. He's a self-made man. And when, he doesn't speak English. His command of English is rather, very weak, used to be weak. And people like that used to be laughed out of court in India. India was a very cruel place for people like that. But he was unassailable because he had very strong convictions. And he rises to power. And his rise to power is truly inspiring for many, many people in India who see this man as a model for themselves. If he can do it, we can do it. In 2014, when he first came to power, I remember speaking to people in Mumbai, Bombay, and there were Muslim men, Muslim voters saying to me that, I really am scared of him. But at the same time, I look at him and think anything is possible. I look at him as, the embodiment of the potential of Indian democracy. Its redeeming capacity that you can be anything and still, come to the helm in this country. That's an extraordinary story. And now contrast that with Rahul Gandhi. Rahul Gandhi is the fifth generation Dynast, not first or second, fifth generation Dynast, who glided into politics because his mother brought him. When he was a member of parliament, he had one of the worst attendance records of any parliamentarian. He was put, I think, on the defense committee, and he barely ever showed up. And between 2014 and 2019, he averaged five foreign trips every month, right? So every time that there was an opening to oppose the prime minister, every time the prime minister screwed up, the leader, the general of the opposite party was absent, was missing in action. And he just disappeared. And now he's gone on a little march across India, trying to liken himself to Mahatma Gandhi, who went on a similar march against the British. But that march is not so much a mission to redeem India. It's really a spectacle of his own vanity. He has repeatedly been rejected by the Indian electorate. And you've been rejected two times. To go back to the electorate the third time with the same choice is not to offer them an alternative, it's to proffer them an insult. And Rahul Gandhi is an insult, a slap in the face of the Indian electorate that doesn't want this entitled princeling. And yet he says, "You have no choice. I am the only person you have. Suck up and no, suck on this." And what does the Indian electorate do? His own pocket borough, his family's pocket borough, Amethi, of which he was a member of, he was a representative for about 10 years from that constituency, and you should go there, it's medieval. They voted him out. It's inconceivable that a Gandhi would lose from that place. And they actually defeated him. So he carpet-bagged his way into parliament from southern India, from Kerala, by defeating a left-wing candidate, by playing, sectarian politics, by appealing to one section of the electorate there. And this man is really, I seriously think, I've written extensively and repeatedly, I've written open letters to him. And I know that, they've been read because I hear from people in his office. I think having handed two elections to the Prime Minister, he should have retreated from public life. But the fact that he's now the de facto leader of the Congress Party and on the cusp of handing a third electoral victory to Modi is just shattering and shameful. And I think if he, India's tragedy is not that there is a strong man. We've had strongmen before. Other countries have strongmen. India's tragedy is the absence of a viable opposition capable of mobilizing the deepening resentment against the Prime Minister into a unified political action. In America, when there was Trump, the Democrats just united, right? In India, the opposition simply refuses to unite. They fall apart. The India Alliance you speak of, it parties left over power sharing agreements because it's driven by power, not by any high ideals. And I think, frankly, if Modi wins another term, not to be flippant about it, I think the leadership of the Congress Party should commit mass suicide. Someone should give them a barrel of scotch and the address to the nearest tall building and tell them for the sake of the country to get it over with.
That much is at stake, you feel. Yes, well, and a third term of Modi really is,
Yeah, this
as
is
you,
an existential election.
yes.
The significance of this election, this has existential significance, this election, where what we could come out of this election as the Hindu version of Pakistan. We could come out of this election as a plebiscitary autocracy, right? Where you have elections, but the big man rules, and where one religion has primacy over all others. In law, everyone might be equal, but in life, practitioners of one faith end up having being treated as natural citizens, and everyone else is a second-class citizen, second-tier citizen, and that's what we might end up as.
So it's extremely important that we talk about this. And you've told us a little bit about Modi, the self-made man that appeals to even people from religions that he blatantly doesn't care about. What is the history of the BJP party, the party that Modi leads? What is the history there?
It's a very young party. It's in its current avatar. It used to be. So to understand the BJP, let's understand Hindu nationalism. Hindu nationalism is a very young movement. Its roots go back to the late 19th century and early 20th century. It begins in Bengal, where the collision between Britain and India creates this extraordinary ferment, intellectual ferment, and some of India's finest thinkers and intellectuals emerge in this time. And Calcutta is really, capital of, there's an Indian Renaissance happening there at this time. For all the evils of the empire that we talk about, it also gives rise to an intellectual recruitment. And within that intellectual efflorescence, there is one segment that actually thinks that India has fallen behind because Hinduism is such a formless faith. It really, you cannot bottle it up, you cannot give it a shape or a form. So they try to cast it into, they try to give it shape, and they use the templates supplied to them by Christianity and Islam. And then that template really, the obsession with the people who see Christianity as a template go in a different direction. They become reformers. The people who see Islam as a template, they're driven by real resentment. They really want to mimic Islam. They really want to recreate Hinduism in the image of what they fear and loathe. And they Hinduism then, Hindu nationalism then acquires, there are writers who produce writings about Hindu community, but there isn't really a market for this, you see. And then Hindu nationalists really are a pressure group within the Congress Party. Congress is this broad tent fighting for India's independence, led by Mahatma Gandhi. And Hindu nationalists are one wing of it. Communists are another. Capitalists are another. Socialists are another. It's a very broad tent party. But then something happens. The caliphate in Turkey is collapsing. And Gandhi, in one of his most tragic misjudgments, decides to politicize that or indigenize that, Indianize that by saying that the fall of the caliphate has ramifications for Indian Muslims. And so he tries to mobilize India's Muslims by speaking emotionally, by making the survival of the caliphate in Turkey a cause. Many, many modernizing and modernizing moderate Muslims are appalled by Gandhi. They say, here you are reforming your own religion. But in order to bring people from our religion onto your side, you're appealing to their basest instincts. The caliphate falls apart, and the result of that is extraordinary violence. And one of the regions where the violence happens is in the Malabar coast in Kerala, where I was, where the Muslims go on a rampage and they forcibly convert Hindus. The left-wing historians put a gloss on this. They say it was all about property rights and all that, which isn't true. It was an explicitly religious violence. And the news spreads up to Delhi. And the reactions of the leadership of the Congress Party are really stunning. Gandhi refuses to condemn the killers. He actually says, these people are really upset. That's why they've done this. And many of the Hindu, the pressure group, the Hindu nationalist pressure group, are appalled and they break away from the Congress Party. One of them is a physician. His family come from Hyderabad, where I am in this region, and they have fled Hyderabad, fled religious persecution by Muslims in Hyderabad, and settled in Western India in Maharashtra. And he founds what is called the RSS, which is the mothership of Hindu nationalism. And RSS is a pretty radical organization that actually wants to abolish caste, but it is also it wants to create a Hindu identity. It sees Indians as Hindus, and then the RSS doesn't, however, have a market because the dominant party is the Congress Party. But when India is partitioned in the name of religion, because the Muslim League, which is a Muslim nationalist party, demands a state for Muslims of India, and the British relent and say, all right, here's a state of yours. The Hindus say, hang on a second, why do the Muslims get a state and why don't we get a state? And also, their argument is that India, throughout its history, has welcomed people of every faith from every corner of the world, from Zoroastrians to Christians to Jews to Muslims. Only the Muslims have divided India, mutilated India. And India's geography has a sacred significance for Indians. It is to Hindus what, say, Jerusalem is for the Jews. And that then, the creation of Pakistan immediately creates a market for Hindu nationalists who argue that if a state has been created for India's Muslims, what remains should logically be seen as a state for its Hindus. And that argument is a very powerful one, but one of the Hindu nationalists goes and assassinates Gandhi because he talks about peace between Hindus and Muslims and between Pakistan and India. And that then puts the lid. There's such an outrage against Hindu nationalists, in Maharashtra and other places, many of them are lynched. For about 20 or 30 years, they have no currency in Indian politics. They're completely and utterly discredited. But they then make a comeback in the 80s, And their comeback really is the legitimacy they gain is a result of the screw-ups of the secular establishment. The secular establishment becomes so venal and so corrupt in the course of 30 years. Congress goes from being this movement that's emancipated India from the British into a chattel of one family, right? It goes from being Mahatma Gandhi's great movement into a plaything of the Nehru Gandhi family, who have nothing to do with Gandhi, by the way. They just share that name. And it loses all its moral luster. As a result of that, and in 1975, Mrs. Gandhi, Indira Gandhi, suspends the Indian constitution and rules as a dictator. She's a straight-up dictator. Habeas corpus are suspended. People are picked up and tortured. My own father was one of those activists. My late father was picked up and tortured. Hundreds and thousands of people. And it's the Hindu nationalists who actually go, who join the battle to save Indian democracy from this dictatorship. And suddenly Indian voters think, these people are saving democracy from the very people who claim to be the guardians of the best values of India's independence movement. And by the 80s, the Hindu nationalists are a real force in Indian politics. And the BJP is founded in 1980 as a successor to another party called Jan Sangh. And it's founded in 1980. 1984, Indira Gandhi's son, Rajiv Gandhi, becomes the prime minister when his mother's killed by a Sikh, by her Sikh bodyguards. And he starts making a cascade of concessions out of fear that he'll lose power. So what he does is extraordinary. A Muslim woman is granted alimony by the courts. And this is a very significant event in India's history. There's a Muslim woman called Shahbano Begum who is divorced on religious grounds by her husband, and she seeks alimony, and her case, ends up over the years in the Supreme Court of India, which says that the personal laws of Muslims, which are valid in India as a means to assure Muslims, India allowed Muslims to keep their personal laws. But the Supreme Court decides that the personal laws will always be subordinate to the secular laws of the state. So you, as a woman, are entitled to alimony. And this outrages a lot of Muslim men who go on a rampage and they burn things down and they kill a few people. And Rajiv Gandhi, rather than say, damn you, I'm going to stand by this woman, he pushes through legislation in Parliament, blocking the ruling of the Supreme Court. Nullifying the ruling of the Supreme Court and denying alimony to this woman. And within, once again, his colleagues, Muslim colleagues who are moderate, modernizing, walk away from him in disgust. Arif Muhammad Khan, one of the great young leaders at the time, he's now the governor of Kerala and he's a member of the BJP. Today, that man walks away from Congress in disgust. He says, you are playing with my people. You are making them hostages to the most extreme elements in our religious community. But that passes for secularism. And then to make up for the Hindus who are appalled, he opens the gates to the Babri Mosque, which is a 500-year-old mosque that Hindus claim is built on the site of a Hindu temple that was razed by the Mughals. So he opens that up for Hindus to worship in. And then to appease the Muslims upset by that, he places a ban on Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses. His book Knife has just been published, so it's very topical. He places a ban. India becomes the first country to place a roundabout ban on the Satanic Verses. It's not Iran, it's actually India, a secular government in India. And Rajiv Gandhi ends his term effectively promising to build what the Hindu nationalists claim they will build. And for a second term, he says, if you elect me again, I will build the kingdom of Rama, the great virtuous Indian king and Hindu god. But the electorate doesn't want him because they have the authentic guys, the Hindu nationalists. And the Hindu nationalists go from 2 seats to becoming the largest opposition party in parliament. And by 1996, they are in power. So that is how they come into power.
Okay, so these concessions made by Rajiv Gandhi in the 1980s, grandson of Nehru, is what opens this force to obviously we can talk about the deeper reasons for the rise of the BJP and Hindu nationalism, but there's something totemic about these concessions made by Rajiv in the 1980s that opens the door to the BJP coming to power far more quickly than they may have.
Yes,
yes,
very much so. It quickens the rise of the BJP, because the BJP doesn't. It's a bit like the Shah of Iran already conceding before the Ayatollah Khomeini has even landed in Tehran. You know, he's not even putting up a fight. He's claiming to govern like the Ayatollah before the Ayatollah has even landed. And if you are a supporter of the Ayatollah's politics, you will say, no, I'll actually stick with the Ayatollah. Thank you. Get out of here. And that's pretty much what happened with Rajiv Gandhi.
Well, your book is truly excellent, a short history of how the country came to be what it is. And it's so interesting that India is really, is this land of contradictions. The name Malevolent Republic is so appropriate. I was shocked at just how bloody and violent modern Indian history is. And you make some really interesting arguments about how modern secular historians denied the pre-colonial history, and so led to this, well, wouldn't allow this mature detachment that you need from history to be able to make your peace with it. And so a people without their history are still in the throes of this, you know, inter-religious, inter-communal fighting. And that's such an excellent part of your book. So I just wanted to ask you, what are voters really caring about in these elections? What are the essential issues that will define the way people vote in this election?
One of Modi's great achievements for which he is actually demanding votes is the completion of that circle that you talked about, the violent pre-colonial history. When people do not know their history, they are ripe for manipulation in the name of history, right? And what happened in India is India's tragic past is that India was repeatedly raided, plundered, devastated by waves of Islamic invaders. This is a fact of history. We should just look at this with detachment, right? This has happened everywhere. Invasions, plunder, killings is a fact of medieval history. What India's post-colonial historians did is they played that down. And they played that down for very good reasons. They didn't want to grant ammunition to Hindu nationalists, especially after the creation of Pakistan. If you go to Pakistan and look at their history syllabus, they're very frank about what happened. They say, you know, the guys came from Arabia in the 8th century and slaughtered everyone in Sindh and destroyed Sindh. And they will talk about other waves of invasions. But in India, they're sort of, you find this gravity-defying use of language. You know, it's like these people showed up and, you know, they arrived for a holiday. It's really, to read an Indian textbook about what happened in India for the past 1,000 years is marginally preferable to having the enamel peeled from your teeth. It makes no sense. It's replete with jargon. And young people who come out of school have no linear understanding of their history. And Octavio Paz, the great South American poet and diplomat who won the Nobel Prize, wrote one of the most important books about India, In Light of India, in which he said that, you know, the meeting of the severest form of monotheism and the most vibrant form of polytheism actually provoked a great deal of trauma and bloodshed. And we should have looked at it and considered it carefully and forgotten about it. V.S. Naipaul often counseled Indians that history must be seen to be dead or history will kill. The past should be seen to be dead or the past will kill. We never looked to the past. We refused to look at the past as it was. And as a result of that, we allowed Hindu nationalists to weaponize the past. So the Babri Mosque, which was built in the 16th century by a general of Babur, the founder of the Mughal Empire, was built on the site that was very sacred to Hindus, right? And a succession of Indian historians denied that. They said, you know, that never happened. This is all fantasy. This is all nonsense. And they mocked and ridiculed anyone who made that argument. But people remember that past in their bones and their marrow. People, you know, in the ballads they inherited from their forefathers. And then finally, there was an archaeological survey done on that site, led by a Muslim, as it happens. And it's remarkable. I've read his work. I've looked at him. He's, again, a Muslim in Kerala who says, I entered that building and my conceptions of Indian history completely changed. He said this place was a temple. It had been razed. And the secular historians of India refused to accept that fact and thereby allowed this issue to fester and fester. If they just said, yes, this was a temple, it was razed, but let's move on from it. Let's not destroy a mosque as a result of it. You know, many, many buildings in the past have been repurposed, but let's build a temple elsewhere. Instead, that denialism led to the deepening of the Hindu rage, and a mob went in the 90s, early 90s, and they demolished the mosque. And that was the bloody event that began the transformation of India, that was an assertion of Hindus, coming Hindu ascendancy. And the secular state, which had talked up its virtues so much, didn't do anything. It didn't go and build that mosque again. It just stood by, let that happen, and forgot about it. So the secular state wasn't very powerful when it came to actually fighting the Hindu nationalists. I think they should have sent the army. And when these Hindu nationalists declared a war in India, the state should have sent an army. It didn't do that. Its great strength lay in denying history, mocking people, treating this as, a sort of parlor game. And that's the result of that is before us, I think. And I think we should have really dealt with that history sincerely. And because we didn't, the Hindu nationalists razed the mosque and they built a temple there. And that temple is now the emblem of the new Hindu state that Modi presides over. And he's now telling everyone that this is a symbol of our new India. And vote for me because I've delivered this. And what does it feel like to be an Indian Muslim? In 1947, when your country was partitioned, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, a truly cancerous creature, says to you, you're a Muslim. By virtue of being a Muslim, you are not Indian. Come to Pakistan. And millions of Muslims say, damn you. No, we won't. Salman Rushdie is one of those people who writes eloquently about this, even though his family migrated to Pakistan eventually. He says, no, I'm Indian. My religious identity doesn't define me. The many, many poets, some of the greatest writers in India, some of the greatest poets in India actually leave Pakistan and come to India. The Muslims who leave Pakistan and come to India to reclaim the pluralistic heritage of India. And how do these people feel when they see India becoming a facsimile of Pakistan? What is the obligation of people who belong to the majority faith? Do we reassure them? Do we say that, we're not going to kill each other over our history? I think that sense of restraint has disappeared in India as a result of Modi's reign. I think he's said to people that, I can't give you jobs, but I will give you the therapeutic option of feeling good about yourself by tormenting Muslims.
Yes, I will give you an identity, a story, a narrative, something that
That's
gives
right.
you
That's right.
something
Milosevic,
more meaningful than jobs.
Slobodan Milosevic used to say that if we can't build an economy, at least we can fight a war. And Modi, who was very much like Milosevic in many ways, a loner, he and an ethno-religious nationalist, he pretty much is doing the same thing. Milosevic said that. Modi is demonstrating that. Modi says, he's been unable to do anything he promised to do. So he lies about India being this great power that the world, everyone in he calls himself the teacher to the world. And, I can't give you a job, but I can give you a very vulnerable, defenseless minority whose head you can smash.
And on that note, Kapil, thank you so much for joining us on the Reaction Podcast.
Thank you so much, Max. It's been a pleasure. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Reaction Podcast. Kapil's book, Malevolent Republic, A Short History of the New India, is out now in a revised paperback edition, and I would urge you all to go and get that. It's the best way to understand what's happening in that complicated and fascinating country at the moment. If you're not a Reaction subscriber, please consider becoming one. For £8 a month or £80 annually, you'll receive Ian Martin's weekly newsletter, incisive analysis from the team's daily briefing straight to your inbox, and the best commentary from our columnists, including Adam Bolton, Tim Marshall, and Maggie Picaro. Until next time, thank you for listening.